Okay. This is the Decade of Style panel. I'm going to blow through the introductions really fast so we can get to questions, because really the interesting part here is the questions, not the introductions. So, assuming that I can make this thing work. The panel. Dun. We've got Chris Wilson over here to my right, who works on the IE team, and I should say I... He claims not to be a serial killer. This is from 1996 or so. I asked all the panelists for pictures from the 95-96 era, and this is Chris's. He sent me the infamous Flock of Seagulls haircut picture, but I promised not to use it. So
it's been overused anyway.
That was from earlier. That was from like 93, which is why I didn't use that. And I forgot to correct the slide, Chris. I'm sorry. It's Spry that he worked on, not Spyglass. I'm sorry. So I'll correct that before I post. I'm perpetuating the myth. No, it's Spry. So that's Chris. He works for the IE team. He's the vendor perspective, sort of the implementer perspective. Now we got Doug Bowman down there on the end.
Who
lovely picture here on the Pacific Coast Highway. Some of you may remember him from stopdesign.com, Wired Redesign. He works for Google now. He also sent me a picture from 93 that I also promised not to use, which is a good thing because if I were to use that picture,
it was a great picture,
I would have to point out that for some reason he reminds me of Matt Mullenweg, and I don't know why.
Perpetual baby face.
It's just, I don't know. Anyway, Molly Holschlag, educator, Standard Easta diva. Isn't she classy?
I sent them really funny pictures of me, but then I threw this one in.
Well, I didn't use that one either. So, she's been using CSS actually 3 months longer than I have.
I know.
So
he threatens. He wants to know when I will retire.
Retire so I can hang on for four months and beat her record. That's right.
You only need 3 months, one day.
Well, I thought I'd go for the extra.
For the extra.
Right, to make it harder for the next person to break my record. Anyway, and then there's me. This is a picture of me from 96. Violating one of my own personal rules, which is never try to eat anything bigger than your head. I don't have another picture of myself because, strangely enough, I'm always behind the camera. This is one where I had to land the camera. This is somewhere in Switzerland. This is the only food stuff that I and my compatriots would have for the next 36 hours. So, anyway. I also have a timeline that I wanted to share with everyone before we get to the questions here. This is a sort of a timeline of the last 10 years with major milestones in the evolution of CSS and also major browser releases. For Internet Explorer, we have Windows on the top and Mac on the bottom. That's not a political statement. I don't want to hear about it later. Thank you very much. Look, Mac, stop. Okay? So I realized belatedly that WWW style, the mailing list being established, was off my timeline. So I had to put the little note there on the side. So this really, the first half takes us up to the IE6, Opera 6, Netscape 6 era. Although the less said about Netscape 6, the better, really. But what I find interesting about this timeline, and the other panelists may have their own things they find interesting, is that the first CSS 3 module drafts were actually in mid-1999. The other interesting thing is that when we zoom forward, the official milestones kind of disappear a little. The browsers keep going, except for one browser that we, you know.
Mac IE?
Yeah.
It's a shame about Mac IE.
It really is a shame about Mac IE. I agree with you. But I thought I'd start throwing in some community events, as it were, some sort of milestones like the Wired redesign. Thank you, Doug. ESPN redesigning, CSSN Garden, those sorts of things. I thought about putting on publication dates for articles that detailed techniques, for example, faux columns or those sorts of things. But then, unfortunately, I realized that if I did that, they would all end up overlapping each other and we wouldn't be able to tell one from another. So what I'm thinking is that I may, with the help of these fine people and others, do a separate timeline that documents those. But anyway, this is just sort of a, you know, where we've been and where the release dates were. We were all sort of chuckling earlier. If you look over there on the very right, you've got a 7.0 and a 2.0 that line up very nicely, don't they? For IEWin and Firefox. So your favorite browser release may not be on here for that. I'm sorry. But it's a first cut.
I know.
So,
leaving iCab out was very upsetting to me.
Yeah. And I know Conqueror's not on there. Don't kill me until later for that, please. All right. Thanks. So, the questions. Did I miss anything that I should have introduced you guys about? Do you want to start busting my chops
now?
How about
introducing yourself?
I did. I'm the host.
Oh, I'm the host.
And it's Eric Meyer with no S. Thank you. Okay.
You're no longer plural, though.
A little bit of information. Yeah. Everybody knows Eric Meyer. Is that it? Is that just, does he just like walk through world assuming that everybody knows who he is?
No. What I'm walking through, it's assuming, is that if I do a very quick introduction of everyone, if nobody knows who any of us are, they can look it up online later. Questions. We want to get to the questions.
I want to know why the birth of Eric Meyer wasn't on that timeline.
It was because, Doug, that would have been way further back than your birth. So,
but not as far as mine. So, you know,
I wasn't going to say that, but since you brought it up. Okay, so the first question for the panel. When and where did each of you first encounter CSS? Tell us a good story. Something funny. Make it good.
Oh, you better start with these two because it was way before me.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, I started working with tools that Chris was probably working on. I don't know.
So I was first then, I guess?
I think so.
Oh, man. Well, I think you actually had the Style Workshop in 1995.
Yeah,
on your timeline.
November, December 95.
And yep. I was at that, and that actually was one of the things that really got me excited about style sheets and CSS, and that's why I kind of went to my manager when he came in and said, yeah, we want you to implement this frame stuff. I said, well, you know, I was thinking... Netscape doesn't have this CSS stuff. Style sheets would be really cool. It'd be really neat to have. It'd be a great competitive feature. And
did you use the words market differentiator?
I was not quite that much of a tool at that point in time. Maybe I am now.
No comment.
But no comment, yeah.
Molly?
Well, for me, the first exposure to CSS, I actually had the opportunity to do something very crazy, which was to write a book. It's my third book.
Who can count?
What's that?
Who can count?
I can't even count. So okay, so it was, the first few you remember. Mm-hmm. So the third book, somebody wanted the publisher wanted a book on tables and frames. And CSS was emerging right around the same time. And I had been doing a little bit of work with the Microsoft Network, the MSN browsers that were using the engine that i3, which wasn't yet out, were actually putting in there. So I began to do some... I both wrote a book in that year, which is some of the samples I sent you came from. And then... because of the work with the MSN browsers. So in i3.
Okay. All right, Doug?
Oh, I came really late to the game, even though I was exposed to it very early on. I think back around 96, 97, 98, I was working at Hotwire with Jeff Veen, who many of you probably know. And he was on the CSS working group around 98, I believe. Mm-hmm. And he would always come back from meetings to the Hotwire offices, all excited about CSS, like a kid in a candy store. And he would come up to us and say, you guys got to try this out. It's the greatest thing ever. You finally be able to set type larger than font size equals 7.
Because it was wired.
Because it was wired.
No, that was colors. You can use pink.
Yeah.
But it actually get... No.
What, did it go up to 6
five.
Or 7?
5.
This one goes to 11.
Yes.
it does go up to 7.
It goes up to 7.
It goes up to 7.
Anyway,
so I didn't really try it until I think maybe when i5 Mac finally came out around 2000. Because we'd go back to our desks and try it, and nothing would work in Netscape 4. So it didn't make any sense to do it, so we just kept...
Harsh, man.
It's true.
Yeah.
It is true.
So in my case, I actually have this man to thank. For my first encounter with CSS, I was at the WWW5 in Paris. I had scanned my employer into sending me to Paris for a conference. I still don't know how I got away with that. But I just decided to sit in on the W3C track, and one of the presentations in W3C track was about these style sheets that I'd never heard of before, and Chris was on that panel, along with Hokum, Lee, Dave Raggett, and...
Bert.
I have that picture, somebody.
Someone unidentifiable.
Yeah, someone unidentifiable in my blurry, no-flash picture.
I think it was Bert.
Might have been. And totally blew me away. And then I went back to my desk, and nothing worked. So, but somehow I stuck with it, which kind of leads into the next question, which is, what was it about CSS that made you stick with it? I'm going to start with Doug. Especially since you didn't stick with it at first. So, well, I guess in your case, first. What brought you back and then made you stick with it?
I think it was the, and some of you have heard this before, but I think it was the realization of the beauty that it allowed us to create both on the surface and underneath the surface, because we no longer had to deal with a mix of horrible nested tables and font tags inside every single table cell and things like that. So it was, it finally enabled us to create very kind of beautifully, nicely structured HTML, and it was just like it suddenly enabled kind of a whole new wave of design, a whole new way of thinking about design. It's not just on the surface, but it's underneath the surface as well.
Cool.
So for me, it was because people wanted to know more about it and wanted to see more with it. So from an author's perspective, I was getting a lot of queries to write about it, and therefore the research into it and the playing with it was really important. And then, of course, the work I was doing with MSN, we were actually using CSS in, I guess, as early as 1990, probably 5, 6, somewhere right in there. Yeah. We began to really use CSS, so my job depended on it. It was like, if I want that paycheck, so that then I have to write some CSS. But
it's
was really funny.
The cheddar from Ollie.
It's really funny, though. If you look back at some of the things we did, when you look at the class names and things we put together, it's just really, you know.
Bold 10 Verdana?
Bold 10 Verdana or 10 point times.
Right.
And you're using points. Did you see the samples I sent you where there were points and inches being used? That was all being done out of Microsoft. But we had fun, and it worked in IE3.
It worked in IE3. So why would you care about anything else?
That's right.
Yeah.
Why would you,
Chris?
Why would you? I don't know. There's that interoperability issue, isn't there? You know, that the web, Chris? The web is globally accessible via all user agents.
So I think for me, it was about the structural semantics of HTML. This was a few. I think of it as penance in a way. Because I am still responsible for overlapping bold and italic tags, too. And, you know, I'll be paying for that one for a long time.
He's been paying
any more
for
than
a lot.
You'll be paying for the mystery element above the HTML element?
Yeah.
Okay.
Actually, that was me, too.
Okay. Yeah, I know.
You too. Boy, talk about a man.
That was a tool. People used that as a tool.
We're back to the tool. It's all about the tool with you. What's that about?
It's all about the
tool. Not touching that one.
No, good. Okay. And in my case, I think it was, I think my reaction was a lot like Doug's. I just had it earlier because I'm older, a lot, but not as old as you apparently. So Molly,
I still look younger than
you do. I can't stop there. I was working for a university, and so we had sort of avoided the whole table spacer GIF font thing, for basically idealistic reasons. It's like, we're at a university and we don't have to worry about, you know, making things look good. It's all about the information, and, you know, the information has to be accessible, because if some professor using an SGI with some version of a browser that nobody's ever heard of can't get to the web page, we're going to get email and probably he's going to talk to the president. You know, I mean, that you have different pressures in a university. You don't have to worry about meeting deadlines, but you do have to worry about professors basically showing up on your doorstep in an irate fashion. So we had never really gone there, but, you know, still wanted the site to look nice. And so CSS came along. I was like, yes, this, I don't have to have the font tags everywhere. I can make text look really cool. And so sort of that initial flash of lightning impulse is what made me stick with it. And then I think from there, well, I guess from there, since I started writing about it and documenting it, people wanted to know, and I just kept going with it like you did. So,
I find it interesting that you were thinking about accessibility even way back then.
Well, I was at a university. We had to. I mean, you know, when you have, you know, the random professor with an SGI running a browser nobody's ever heard of is not a random example. I could probably remember his name. Oh yeah, I can.
But the accessibility is more, actually, you're talking about interoperability. You're talking about
interoperability.
Access for all. Universality.
Yeah, and accessibility too, because, you know, if you have a student who's blind and they can't use the website, that's a problem. I think that's true if you have a commercial user who can't use a website because they're blind, but, you know, It's just we had a different focus. We didn't have to worry so much about, you know, maximizing revenue or whatever. At a university, you don't have to worry about that, right? Usually. Or at least you didn't when I was at university. I don't know how it is now, but
profit-driven.
Yeah, we didn't really have to worry about that so much. So it was, yeah, ivory tower, but there's something to be said for the ivory tower. So, okay. So, your favorite CSS property. We're going to start with you, Chris.
Right on.
Right on.
Scroll bar color.
Scroll bar color. Fabulous. Yeah, but unfortunately, that's not CSS, so you're going to have to come up with another answer.
How do you define CSS?
Ooh. In a CSS spec.
Yeah. Oh, well, MSDN.com has it.
How about inset clip?
There you go. Wow, my favorite CSS property. Margin, actually.
Yeah. Why?
Margin, because it was the first super sexy property. It was the first thing you really could not do in any way, shape, or form with HTML. Like, other than, you know, just putting in paragraph breaks and stuff like that.
Okay, really, so because it, like, instead of letting you have one space, two space, three spaces based on your BRs, it kind of like a space and a half. For
in the presentation you did at Media, mm-hmm. you showed this example, like mocked up example of something that I showed at that 95 conference, or 96 conference. And that was all negative margins. Right? It was like this hidden power inside margins. And they're really, you know, it was very simple, but really very powerful.
Voodoo.
So even then we were hacking negative margins to make things happen.
Absolutely.
Oh, man. Okay. I'm sorry, what, Doug?
I was just calling it voodoo, negative margins. Voodoo.
Negative margin voodoo. Negative
mojo.
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 People, if you want to come forward,
please.
Oh, I see. There's seats.
Yeah.
Seats.
I'm sorry.
Lots of seats up front.
We're just going to say there's... Please move all the way to the middle of your row. Anyone who's been to Disney will remember this spiel.
Let's see. I think this is called style switching, right?
It's optimization.
Letter spacing and letting.
Right. So that people can move forward.
I think it's justification, actually.
Yeah. Letter spacing normal. Attendee spacing normal. That's... Okay, Molly, your favorite property.
My favorite property. Actually, I have many, many favorite properties, and I really enjoyed Chris's perspective because I agree very much. But my favorite property is the display property.
Okay.
I think the reason is because it's so fundamentally powerful in being able to actually manipulate elements from their default display value. So... the unfortunate thing about display is that it is, you know, we're very accustomed to using it, like, you know, just to use display none or inline, that sort of thing, block. But we're limited to those uses, and there are other uses for it that are very powerful and have not been consistently implemented across the board. It's very bad support.
Mean like run-in?
Yeah.
Yeah, display run-in.
I love that. Yeah, I wrote about that not too long ago.
I had to defend you. Against some people
who didn't think that, but actually, it's a very, very from a designer standpoint, that makes a lot of sense to do.
Oh yeah,
you know. So I'd like to see display not only. I mean, obviously, we'll have continued support for it because it plays such a role in navigation now. But I think that that a lot more can be done with that particular property.
Yeah, Doug.
Oh, the best property is by far text decoration with the value of. Blink.
Yeah, baby.
And we were actually discussing this earlier. I realized that like Firefox and Camino support it quite well, and I got on Chris's case because I didn't think IE supported it. He said...
No, we support it. The spec actually explicitly says you don't have to blink the content. You just have to recognize the value and
just ignore it altogether.
Yeah.
We don't ignore it. We don't ignore it. We store it. You can look for it in the object model. It gets persisted. It's there.
You can address it by JavaScript.
We were very concerned about the epileptics who might look at that and the blinking could throw them into a fit
But that has
it's actually true.
No defense for a marquee, of course.
Scrolling is totally different.
Oh, I see. It's blinking versus scrolling. But no, I want to see. A marquee value for
text decoration marquee. Yeah.
Please,
so that way you can do blink and marquee at the same time.
And actually, I'd like to point out something.
If you get that one in, I'll make text decoration blink actually blink.
Awesome.
Ooh, you heard
awesome.
It here first, folks.
But it has to be in an actual approved CSS spec.
Okay, I'll just go beat everybody.
That gives
up.
You that'll give
Put
you a good decade or two.
Before you have to worry about this. I'm safe.
And let's remember, text decoration values can be combined. So you could have a marquee blinking.
Blink. That's what my point is. I want marquee blink, don't
who,
you?
Who did that back in the HTML that? Terrorist
who
days?
Who wants marquee blink? Yeah. Who wants a marquee value?
Okay, so who back in the old days did the HTML, quote-unquote, HTML terrorist type thing where you wrapped an entire page in a blink and then you wrapped that in a marquee? Anyone besides
me? Or how about the multiple HTML tags with different colors so you could fade the page?
Right.
That was my personal. We got a hand. All right.
Multiple title elements
multiple
so that you like scroll the title bar.
Okay, wait. How about a real property that I'm actually a fan of is background? Because it's responsible background for the beautification of CSS space websites.
That's a great point. There you go. Designer especially too.
There you go.
Yeah.
I think
multiple backgrounds.
My favorite property is more linked to working group memories. It's clip.
Clip. Oh, yeah. How many people are using Clip right now, today?
I'm astonished that it's that many.
That many.
And the reason I say that is that at a working group meeting, back when I was in the working group, we spent, I think, almost all day, this was in 2000, trying to figure out how to reconcile Clip in the spec with Clip as implemented in IE for Windows, which was based on an earlier draft of the spec. Like, Clip did one thing, and IE for Windows implemented it, and then they changed Clip, and then there was this. So we, like, argued about what it should be for hours, and, like, literally the chair of the working group left the room screaming.
And that never happens.
No. And the whole time, I'm like, trying to document it, because CSS The Definitive Guide was coming out, and I wanted it to be accurate. It's still not, because there is no such thing as accuracy in this area. And I think it's my favorite in one of those sort of weird inverted ways in that it's an illustration of what can go wrong if the process isn't followed well. And so it's my favorite because it's a lesson, actually, for people that's sort of interior. Other than that, sort of on the front edge, I don't know. I think Overflow, because it's got so much voodoo in it that I still don't understand. But there's weird stuff you can do with Overflow that I still don't get. So, anyway. I mean, the basics are clear enough, but the fact that Overflow auto causes float containment, I don't get it. Okay, anyway. Yeah. Moving right along. So here's a question. So if you remember the timeline, there was a lot of stuff happening in those first 5 years, and then nothing happened. But those of you who were around for those first 5 years, remember that there was using CSS was, let us say, a challenge. What I'd like to know, what the panel thinks, what the panel believes, how did CSS even make it to where it is today? Why did it not get abandoned in those first 5 years when, you know, nothing worked in Netscape but worked in IE or vice versa, or, you know, nothing worked cross-browser? I mean, we complain today about stuff not working cross-browser, but, I mean, compared to the way it was, we've got it so easy, and so how did it survive? Anyone? We're not even going in order.
All right, I'll grab this one. I remember working with table-based layouts, and of course, having to every time you wanted to make a font change, let's say, right? You had to each cell had to have that font that you needed.
Assuming you cared about validation or well formatted, right?
No,
consistent table cells would reset the.
Did they back then?
Yes,
okay.
Exactly.
See, it's been so long.
Actually,
it still resets the
font
size. You can do it now, and it's the same thing.
Yeah, it resets the font size, but it doesn't reset the font face.
And then there's color.
Netscape
also
actually implemented the table cells and font sizes first, and they reset it. And when we did font face, we were the first to implement it, and we had it not reset for table cells.
Yeah,
it's been so long.
And you could even do base font, and it didn't work.
Base font.
Okay, sorry.
Yeah,
but, go ahead.
But the bottom line was that it became so. Even working with table based layouts, I look at some of the stuff that I put together for the Web Directions North keynote that I did on our crimes against web standards. And one of the funniest things that I found when
did
I was
you use my picture from 93.
I didn't use your picture, Chris. I'm sorry.
That's all me, baby.
It was. I used him a lot. But sorry. Next time, I'll use you.
That's all right. I'm not using the picture. I don't need to be on the crimes part.
Yeah, okay, yeah. Yeah.
Because you do look like a serial killer in that one.
So at any rate, the point being that I looked at some of my early code examples, and actually, they're very clean, even though they're presentational, right? Lots of breaks and, you know, paragraphs and paragraph non-breaking space kind of things. All the things that we are familiar with in terms of hacking HTML to make a visual approach. And I think what became very clear was that as we began to do that, to get more and more presentation into the documents became unmanageable. You know, and it was very clear that CSS was powerful. So I think that just the idea was what made me hang on to the hope, because it was like, I can have a more, you know, a better structured document with more flexibility if I was able to do that. And you could see that right away, and you a lot less work too.
So you think that you think that most people saw that, and that's sort of why
I don't know what other
going.
People saw. Yeah. Show of hands, did people really find that working? How many people worked with tables and fonts and the spacer gifs and all of that, and how to do all of that? Yeah. So that, to me, when you began to see that shifting away into CSS, when we were able to really start dropping some of that stuff, it made work easier.
Yeah.
And I think that just became really quite the reason.
Anyone else? How did it survive?
I was just going to say, also, even though it didn't really pick up on a wide basis, wow.
I guess we've got
time to use your Zeus voice.
Mood lighting.
Even though it didn't pick up on a very fast, wide basis, I think the concepts were still there, as you were saying. Like, it was very clear that separating presentation from markup was very powerful. The ability to style thousands of pages with one file and not have to go in and change all of your HTML files everywhere just to change styles or to change the color of something. The concept was very powerful, so it just remained kind of existing until other people started to discover it later on.
Okay, so that the promise is what kept it alive. That was enough, you think?
I think it was sexy. I mean, it did attractive things that you simply couldn't do in HTML. Right? You didn't have tools like negative margins. You barely had font control. And you know, things like floating on elements other than images. That, you know, you had a lot of power there. Okay. I think that
even
it took
in the
a
early
while.
Days?
It took a while for people to really get the hang of what that separation of presentation and content really meant and how it could be used. But I think the immediate effects of, you can control all these things and make your layout look really pretty, that I think they started getting right away.
Okay. So if I'm reading the panel correctly, it's sort of a people started using style sheets in really basic ways, but they were still able to use them for their whole site. So even if your style sheet was just fonts and colors,
that's right. That's, yeah. I think that was everybody. I think everybody started that way. Yeah.
Okay, and fonts, so having that sort of kept it right there. So people would say, "Well, I've got the style sheet, and God, I wish I could do more with it." Yeah. But browsers aren't up to doing more than fonts and colors, and then eventually browsers got there, and that's basically what it was. So
that's what I think.
So there was at least the minimal. There was useful functionality and tons of promise, and then as the promise became, like, people were able to wait for the promise. Okay, that's interesting, because I sometimes wonder what is it that allows certain ideas to survive and others not. I mean, there have been other things, programming languages that basically never went anywhere, for example, or not that I'm trying to say CSS is a programming language, but you know what
but
I mean.
No, it's totally, it is, I totally see the point, because how did it really survive? It had to, obviously we saw the power in it and were, obviously, not only that, there were models before CSS. CSS wasn't like, dreamt up in Howcom's mind.
It was not sprung fully formed from someone's forehead. Right.
I mean, when you go back to desktop publishing, when you go back to traditional print design, you look at the way that, let's say, Quark or any of your other publishing tools work. You have a master style sheet. I mean, those things have existed for a very long time. And we had, I think, a legacy also that made sense. And again, as Doug said, the idea that you're separating this, it makes sense. It gives the designer more power, and I think that's why. But that it survived as long as it did is very interesting, and is a point. It's a key point that people should not miss.
Right. Yeah, because there would be lessons there for the future.
We wouldn't be talking about CSS now.
If it hadn't survived, which is
not only that, if it hadn't been, it's still a struggle.
Yeah, well, that's true too. Okay. Just a couple of key moments in CSS history. Anyone? Wow. Okay. Moving right along.
There's so many, and yet, yeah. and yet.
All right, just name one. Name the first one that comes to your mind.
Zen Garden.
The Zen Garden.
Yeah. Wow.
Whatever.
Where's Dave?
Where's Dave? Is Dave in the
Dave.
Room? Dave Shea. We know he didn't come to our. He has an excuse then.
Yeah.
He's probably still sleeping.
Yeah, but it's only 10:30. He should still be here.
I saw him in the bar last night. I'm pretty sure.
Oh, there it is. All right, we're totally editing this part out of the podcast later.
So no, we're not. It stays in.
No, we're not. It stays in.
No, I think I really
Zen
do.
Zen Garden, wow.
I think Zen Garden was the, and I'm sure the audience, many audience members, little show of hands, how many audience members first really appreciated the value of what CSS could do for an entire document versus
design
these
wise,
things
yeah.
we were talking about, the little fonts and the things. How many people yeah. first
off
saw
the CSS
that in Garden?
Garden wow.
Right?
There yeah. you go, man.
It's hugely, profoundly important in terms
there
of
you go.
Pushing us forward and moving CSS.
All right, I'm going to throw out another one. IE5 Mac. You're welcome, Tontek. I heard him back there somewhere.
Yeah, Tontek's in here.
There he is. There he is. There's that
hey, Tontek.
Because it was to me, it was the first browser that really started to deliver on the promise. It wasn't all the way there. Yeah. I don't think any browser today is all the way there, but it was the first one that really sort of broke through and made, like, you could do stuff and it worked. It was supposed to.
It took the step from what I had yeah. 3 and what I 4 had done for Windows and when
and took it up quite a bit further. And doctype switching, it really paved the way for browsers that followed it.
Absolutely.
And so, you know, I was a beta tester, so, you know, conflict of interest disclosure right there. But
we all love Tontek.
But I think it really marked a turning point. I think without IE5 Mac or a browser like it, I don't think that we would be having this panel, because CSS wouldn't have survived. It would have died slowly, basically. So I'm glad it happened. So who have we forgotten? Who is someone who is basically responsible or influential in this whole field, but we don't think about it anymore because they faded off the scene or whatever? I'm going to start with this one, Todd Farner. How many know that name? Okay, good.
Ooh,
that's pretty
see.
Good.
Yeah.
For the rest of you, Todd Farner did a lot of writing about typography and CSS in the early days, and in fact, it basically proposed the idea of doctype switching. For that alone, yeah. he deserves to be on this list. He left the field. I don't know. He cashed out. He builds bicycles now.
Bicycle
sell human-powered bicycle motors.
He was also responsible for the first image replacement idea.
Right,
yeah,
Farner image replacement. Right.
Yeah.
So there you go. That's mine. Anyone else?
Well, I always like to say the name Rob Chandonnais, who I've never met,
I didn't know the name.
Most people don't. Does anybody know that name?
Rob Chandonnais. Anyone?
Anybody? What if I said Blue Robot?
Yeah. That was Blue Robot. I didn't know his name
Blue
until
Robot.
Today.
Who knows? I mean, it's funny because a lot of us, you know, we're obviously tribal. Look at our community, very close. We talk a lot. Everybody knows everybody else or tries to in this group. And he is one person who I've never seen, never met, never. I exchanged emails with him, though, mm-hmm. so he does mm-hmm. exist.
Yeah. Well.
And Blue Robot was really, along with Eric Costello, I have to say, as well, is another one.
Glish.
With glish.com. Yeah. Those were the really...
Him I've met.
Yes. People actually have seen Eric as opposed to Rob. But the thing is that I think both of those guys, what they really did is they were the ones that put the first layouts online, you know, the
right.
first sample layouts. And so that began the whole movement now taking CSS from just the fonts and styling and margin on through to an entire page layout okay. methodology.
Who else?
Owen Briggs.
Briggs.
Anyone know his name?
Yeah.
The box lessons.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And all of he's the one who did all the screenshots of all the types.
Yeah, he had like 264 font size screenshots. Yeah, that's Owen too.
TheNoodleIncident.com
for those.
Yeah.
Little Calvin and Hobbes. Anyone?
Vitter Apparel.
Yeah, Vitter.
Yeah. Vitter was the Netscape representative. Mm-hmm. To the CSS working group and actually also the DOM working group. And at the time, he was kind of my counterpart because I was on both of those working groups for Microsoft and just, you know, completely fell off the face of the earth at some point after that. But, you know, really did a lot to bring that into a multiple browser implementation. And I think for that deserves a lot of credit.
Cool.
You could probably also put up like all the names of the CSS samurai.
That's a problem.
Yeah,
that's
actually, some are still around. Back when I thought I was going to have really screenshots, I thought about having that screenshot in here, but the CSS Samurai as well. So if anyone doesn't know about the CSS Samurai, Google for them later.
You can find them on the Web Standards project.
The archives.webstandards.org?
No, webstandards.org. What?
Yeah.
Oh, it's in the archives down right now.
Okay, the Web Standards archive is down at the moment, but it will be back, we hope. And so, so what's the biggest missing piece in CSS? Either...
there's that.
I didn't hear.
Tables. You said tables.
The biggest missing piece is tables, huh? You know what? Display table were implemented universally.
Well, are we talking about the spec or are we talking about...
I know. I'm just kidding you.
I'd actually say a comprehensive, complete interoperability and test suite.
Hmm. Ooh.
Wow.
Ooh.
A test suite.
Plus, I like the sound of that, Chris. That's awesome.
Good luck with that.
Get right on that.
Yeah.
Oh, I think my new work is appearing suddenly on my desk. Is that
yeehaw.
For me, I think any mechanism of, you know, multi-column, columnar layout issues, anything that has to do with column-based design, being able to, if you look at print, for example, sometimes we're able, like you can take two columns or around and have them meet, you know, and come together and things like that from a design perspective that we can't do.
So really, like a high-powered layout language,
high-powered, like, yes. Yeah. Like if you look at the work that's being done in the CSS3 working group, there's some interesting stuff with the layout being done by Cesar over in Spain. Mm-hmm. But I'm not sure we're anywhere close. And mm-hmm. I'm not sure that, you know, when I read the specs, when I read the history, and I look back and I think, oh, CSS was built as a layout language, positioning doesn't cut it.
No.
Floats were never meant for what we use them for. So we are missing a big chunk right there of how to actually do page layout in CSS.
Yeah, I'm going to agree with that one. Doug?
I think actually two things that are unrelated to each other that are missing. One, and you're going to be surprised because it's not design related at all, but variables and constants.
Mm.
Some way to just set them once.
Hey! I hear applause.
Yeah,
everywhere else.
Variables and constants, yeah.
And I still think we're missing appropriate tools that the masses can use that address CSS without even ever having to touch a line of CSS.
Mm.
So,
and, you know, and of course, WebCiv with John Alsop, they've been working on that for a long, long time. It's a very hard problem to solve.
And John actually was going to be on the panel, but he had to cancel out of the conference, unfortunately. Yeah. But I would have liked to have his perspective.
Yeah, his perspective on that would have been great.
Yeah. So, anyway.
How many designers in the room, by the way, just who would love to have, a WYSIWYG that you could open up and...
Yeah.
No?
See, now
you're a boo hiss.
If you could work, okay, visual, like graphic artists, purely trained graphic artists, if you could work within a graphical environment, right, and have CSS created by that, whatever tool you're using, that would really cut down on certain problems we have in the industry, wouldn't it?
But isn't that the route Dreamweaver's been trying to take for a long
Everybody
time?
Everybody has. Yeah, but you know what? Until we have learner, like, okay, we cannot have semantic meaningful markup and a software product that understands that and then applies styles to it properly. Like,
and it's interesting. We could have an entire panel on should web designers have to code or not.
I mean, no. I mean, it's a huge issue.
Should they be allowed to only do it in the WYSIWYG, or do they have
That's
to understand?
That's the point.
So we're not going to have this be that.
Does
panel.
Everyone have to start with Notepad?
Right. Does it? Yeah.
That's a good
exactly.
question. Does everyone
next
have to?
Year.
Yes.
Next
I think.
Year.
Next year. Does
next
it?
Year.
Yeah. Next year. Should designers know how to hand code? There we go.
There we go.
I've already got a problem. Is Hugh in the room?
Hugh.
Anyway.
Well, I think this generation feels that very strongly. But what about 5 years from now? 10 years from now?
I don't know. So, yeah, but I'm going to agree. My answer is the same as yours as far as the missing piece. We need a major layout language.
Yep.
So how about the CSS working group? Have they lost their way or no? Anyone? Come on.
Okay, I think that they're...
Honesty.
I think that they're getting smarter in the fact that they've brought designers in for the first foreseeable
Finally.
Time.
You say designers in the plural.
Yes.
Is that fair?
Yes.
Okay.
Andy
How many designers
Andy
do they have?
Clark is there, okay. and Cindy Lee is backup for Kevin Lauber.
Okay.
So those are two
the plural is
visual
is
designers
okay.
that are actually
squeaked in
involved
the
in creating the you know.
Mm-hmm.
And what was, you know, it's not only designers. It's like, where are the programmers? I mean, we're it's like, who did Bang Important? I mean, how many programmers in the room? Man. When you get to Bang Important, what does that mean?
Not important.
Not important. But of course, that doesn't mean not in CSS, right?
Thank
so
you.
So what's up with that?
Yeah,
dude?
What's up with that?
Hey, don't look at me. That was one of Hauken or Bert. And you know, with CSS2, they actually also flipped the meaning of user style sheets, which they argued against for like a day at the working group meeting.
Because we
already implemented
it.
And then finally I said, okay, whatever, guys. You know, you think this is going to solve accessibility problems. I've explained to you how it doesn't actually solve anything because nobody will use it for accessibility.
Yeah.
And I don't think any... who uses Bang Important for accessibility? Thank you.
Look at W3C website.
Is anyone using user style sheets to improve accessibility purposes, or know of anyone who is? Okay, I see one hand.
One, two, three, that's Sean.
Hi, Sean. Accessibility maven.
Right, Sean and Kimberly. I gotta hear this.
Well, we talk about it later, but that still the working group now. Come on, be honest.
I think it's tough, right?
I mean, I think it's really tough.
It's a challenging mission. I think from a personal perspective, and for that matter, a professional perspective, the test suite is critical for interoperability. And I think any time the spec does not try to specify everything in enough detail so that you don't have to hack around all the problems of interoperability later. Mm. And CSS2 still does this, right? CSS2.1, the current version, there are still areas of the spec where it basically kind of throws up its hands and says, yeah, whatever the browsers do. Like, they're interoperable enough already. And I hate that. Like, I've argued against this time and time again, but it's challenging for compatibility reasons to change any behavior. And I think that it's always going to be tough to balance that with the desire for any of the browser manufacturers. And I'm actually not talking about Microsoft at the moment, but certainly in the past we've done this repeatedly, to say, oh, we really want this new feature that's stylistic, and let's go get it in CSS. It's currently now a priority for us. And, that doesn't mean that everyone else is ready to sit down and come up with the absolute best solution at the time. So you mentioned before, there's this challenge of aligning to schedules and having, being kind of yanked around by priorities in the working group. And I think that's always going to be a problem. We can't really get away from that.
I personally think that the W3C has lost its way, and it's a trickle-down problem.
Okay.
And that the processes and everything is, you have the same people year after year. I'm not so sure that's a great model. We could talk forever on that one, too.
That's its own panel,
absolutely.
Yeah,
it's its own panel as well.
Oh, yeah.
But bottom line being is that, until things get shaken up, how are you really going to make progress when you have the same circular arguments going on year after year after year with the same people? You don't get any fresh perspective in there, which I hope that bringing other people in is going to mitigate some, but it hasn't proven that yet.
Actually, I have a lot of hope for that one. Says the chair of the new HTML working group, for exactly that reason, right? Yeah. I mean, I didn't agree to take that role because it's going to be some great career move for me or anything. Because I can tell you
really
what its likely value
him,
there
actually.
Is. I think I had a whole blog post about that.
Yeah.
But because I think that it's really critically important, and there are some valuable things about the W3C that we do really need. As a community, we really need. I mean, like, I go on and on about patent policy and that being important. And the reality of it is, bang important.
Bang important.
That's bang important in the important sense, as opposed to the never mind. But, the reality of it is that having a patent policy and working under one, whether it's a great one or a perfect one, or I don't think there is a perfect one, really, but having one is critical for everyone. And, when you get the Microsoft guy in the room and then you all sign off on a specification, and at the end, some patent turns up that Microsoft happens to have on the concept of style sheets.
For example. just to pick something random.
Just a flashback to 1998, I think it was.
Seven, maybe.
And, having a patent policy actually means you can say, oh, no problem, we all get to share it. It's like there is a defined method of sharing, and I think that sort of thing is critically important. Now, the higher level of the W3C, I think the strategic direction, that's been a problem. I think that's actually gotten yanked around quite a bit in the last couple of years. And you know, with the Web API Working Group and the WAF Working Group. And
I mean, there's
the
good
total
stuff,
restructuring of HTML.
It's, I mean, got, yeah, yeah, but I'm not so, well, we
anyway.
Shouldn't
hey,
even go there.
Doug? Come on, bring it on.
Doug?
No, like,
I don't know that
give
this
me
is,
some direction.
Anything down
I
there?
I will, but we'll do it
no.
off panel.
Okay, that's fine. Doug doesn't have anything on that one. Very diplomatic, sir.
Well,
Tontek's a good friend.
But you've never been involved in W3C processes, have you?
No, I haven't. Yeah. But every time I complain about something, Tontek says, well, write to the email, write to the mailing list. And this yeah. is not how designers usually work.
Well,
you just bitch about
learn,
it later.
Man. Learn. Yes.
Learn.
Like one of the things that is really happening about the W3C in general, but the working groups on it in particular, is that they are being more open and trying to, like, this was a huge comment on the HTML working group charter. We went around and around on this about being open and doing everything out in the open and allowing anyone to participate. And, you know, there's still some constraints on that with patent policy, but it basically means anybody in this room can participate in the design of HTML or any of the other specs that are changing this way and not, you know, have to be a member of the W3C in the pays $50,000 a year or whatever the
right.
current fee is sort of model.
That's awesome, I mean, though. That yeah. piece of it is
that's,
very wonderful.
Yeah, that's yeah. very important. Yeah.
So
I'd like to see that with the CSS. How many people would like to see that with CSS, where you had a say as individuals? Yeah?
Who would participate, I think, is probably
yeah,
a better
participate?
Question.
Who would actually
really?
Participate?
Even, you know,
honest.
Really,
okay.
right on. Yeah, that's
right
that's
on.
Awesome.
That's awesome,
really
yeah.
Awesome.
So what's the hardest part of CSS for each of you, from your individual perspectives?
Ooh, me,
go.
Me.
Quick.
Compatibility.
Yeah.
Compatibility is a killer. I make
so
this...
So compatibility with others?
I make this regular speech. No, actually, backwards compatibility for us is
okay.
absolutely critical.
Yeah.
So,
yeah,
for example, IE7, like, come on, guys, we know it doesn't get everything right. Like, we get that. No, we do actually test things. Shocked and appalled. But, for example, I know there are still some problems with our floating implementation. The problem is fixing those problems today and in the next version of IE is going to be a backwards compatibility problem. Fixing all the things that we did in IE7 actually caused a bunch of compatibility problems. And the doc type switch, as awesome as it is, it doesn't get us any mileage anymore. I mean, back in, I want to say, 92, 93, we actually we tested the top 200 websites, and exactly one of them was in strict mode, was in standards mode, like not in quirks mode. And I ran this test again a week ago, and 49% of them were actually in standards mode. 49% of the top 200 websites, the US, the international is slightly lower.
You so, said 1993, did you mean 2003?
Sorry, 2003,
yeah, I was
yes,
gonna say 1993.
In 2003, basically nobody was using standards mode. Like everyone was in quirks mode of the most popular sites. Today, it's like half.
That's amazing.
So if we change something, if
That's
we change
amazing.
How our floating behavior works, we affect our floating behavior for half of the web. We have like 500 million users, so 500 million users times half the web. You know, you figure it out. But it's a lot of people. And my mom is one of them. And she has every phone number that I have.
mine
to.
Too. That's
and I get
my
in
mother
trouble
also.
When I don't pick up the phone. And yeah, so let's, you know, let's not go there. So I think that that's going to be a continuing problem for us, and we do need to come up with a solution for it.
Mm.
We're going to have to come up with the next doc type, right? The next way that people opt in to saying, yeah, I understand what good content looks like, and I understand what compatibility means, and that it's important.
Okay. Molly, Doug?
I think the hardest thing to me, and that this may be because while I understand and have been trained in design principles, I am not fundamentally a designer. And I think that it's extraordinarily difficult for designers to design with unless they have really a lot of experience, a lot of years. You have to know so much in order to do it.
Hmm.
And I think that's, and as an educator, a person who spends a lot of her time teaching CSS, this is one of the things I find most difficult is that, you know, how you can teach the theory. I mean, specificity may be confusing to people, but you can teach it if you have the right examples and you're able. You can teach the hardest parts of CSS, but just because you can teach it and somebody can learn it doesn't mean that they can apply it. And that's where I think there's a difficulty.
Doug?
Hmm. I think it just goes back to the missing pieces that Molly was citing earlier, layout and modularity and positioning and floating and the fact that we don't have proper tools for properly laying out a page.
So the hardest part of CSS is actually having to know CSS? Is that what you're trying to say?
Pretty much, yeah.
Okay.
I'll take that. It's having the CSS but not having the means to use it really expediently and well.
Okay. All right. For me, inline layout, the inline layout model. I spent 2 weeks having Ian Hickson and David Barron club me into understanding it, and I'm still not sure I quite get it. But anyone who's ever really looked at how lines of text get laid out usually comes away from it astonished that browsers ever managed to render anything at all. It's astonishingly complex, so I'm not going to go into all the details now. This one's for Doug.
Designing for CSS differ from designing in general. Well, I think there's actually a critical point here in that CSS is not necessarily a design tool. And I think that's I think one of the most fundamental things that sometimes people don't understand. It's a tool to implement designs. So it's not necessarily a tool or a language that designers will fundamentally just grasp and know right away and attach themselves to, because it's an implementation tool. It's not necessarily a design tool. If you try to design with CSS, you're going to be limited by the limitations of CSS, which I don't think is a good thing. You were talking earlier, sharing general frustrations of working with the designer and having to try to implement what they designed. Mm-hmm. And I think there's often some good things that come out of that relationship, because you get to invent new techniques, new means of implementing something, mm-hmm. rather than sticking with what you know of what CSS and then trying to design with it. Just, I don't think that works.
Okay. Awesome. So, quickly, what do we see in the future? Anyone?
Mr.
Variables and constants.
Layout, 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 layout.
Yeah, better, more powerful interoperability.
Yeah.
Fabulous. So, now it's time for questions from the audience. There's a microphone there, so anyone who would like to ask a question of the panel, please make your way to the microphone. We've got almost 10 minutes, so we managed to... Got to get to the microphone. No, unfortunately, you have to use the microphone because they're podcasting.
Steve, go ahead, Steve.
The chairs are interlocked. Okay, you know what? I didn't realize it was going to be that much of a problem. Okay, well, go ahead.
So, Steve, go back to your seat now.
Let's go ahead and take Steve's question.
So you guys were saying about should designers have a WYSIWYG editor or whatever, so they don't have to understand CSS and HTML and all this sort of thing. Do print designers not have to understand paper?
Good point. That's a really good point.
And that's one of those questions that would form an entire panel. So,
I think you've got panel for next year, Steve.
you know what? Let's do it this way. Could each of the panel members answer whether or not they think that's a valid analogy? I don't think we can really go any further than that, because then we'll like blow the rest of our time. I'll start by saying that I actually largely agree with you. So, others, do you think that's a valid analogy?
When you say not
understand paper, I take it you mean like typesetting and printing and...
Well, even...
Or surfaces of paper.
Surfaces, types, weight,
right. Type, white,
so,
texture.
Do we accept that as a valid analogy? Yes or no?
I'm not sure, because you can still be a great designer and not necessarily understand the fine points of either letterpress or lithography or whatever.
Okay.
So
you would say maybe it's not a valid analogy.
I think it makes a better designer to understand the medium in which you're
absolutely.
Working.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah, I think I'd have to agree with that. I mean, my ideal would be, even in a world where we had good WYSIWYG type products, that not that we don't have workable WYSIWYG. I think Scott Fajette is in the room, so I should be, you know, kind of nice. So no, but the point being is that I think that even when we have the tools, let's say you're using Dreamweaver, which is a very good product, if you know what you're doing. Right? It is your knowledge. Okay. So the tools should never be the excuse, you know? So I think in that way, it definitely holds true.
Okay. The nice lady who I made climb over several people to ask a question, if you could. Oh, great. And then we got a microphone high problem. Go ahead.
Sure.
She's got her question written out.
Written down in a notebook.
That's preparation. Awesome.
I didn't think anyone would notice. I could just
Hey, all right.
Hey. I just want to get it right the first time. Given that we have to deal with certain limitations, I'd like to know about your philosophies for approaching CSS design. Do you code to the least compliant browsers and then think about adding enhancements to the smarter browsers, or do you code to the most compliant browsers and then think about how to accommodate or step around the least compliant browsers? Or is this an either-or situation?
Yeah, that's a great question.
That's a very good question.
My answer is that I comply. I go for the most compliant and then think about fallbacks. That's my answer.
I think there's actually two vectors to that. One of them is compliance and one of them is feature set. Hmm. And I would probably recommend that you be informed by the feature set of the browser with the least set of CSS implemented. But I would design and implement to the most compliant browser first. I'd implement to the standard first, and then hack around the shortcomings, because that's easier to remove later as those get improved.
Yeah, I think my preference of the two would be the same thing: is to start with the best and then fill in the gaps as you have to. However, I don't think it's an either or situation. You have to really analyze the situation that you're designing for first. You have to say, what browsers do I need to include absolutely, and who can I send unstyled content to? And I think that when you know that information, then you have a better way of approaching the project cycle and how it's going to work.
Okay.
Just to give an example of why I think all of us would choose the latter of those, trying to design or kind of build for the most compliant browsers. I was working with a team recently, maybe about a year ago, and they were actually forcing Mozilla or Firefox to, and this was prior to IE7, obviously, to dumb down to IE6's layout model, kind of in quirks mode. And so they were just kind of missing out on a lot of features, and by doing that, they were going to absolutely miss out on trying to make something that worked for all the other browsers as well. Hmm. Safari, Opera, everything else.
Right. So, okay, yes, next question.
Yeah, I haven't been keeping up on all the standards of the new CSS, but it kind of relates to an earlier question. Student once asked me, why is everything square?
Okay.
And my question is, how can we accommodate non-square? And I've been trying to answer that for years, and I still haven't come up with what I think is a good answer. Go ahead.
Everything's square because rectangles are really easy to draw.
Yeah. non-rectilinear is hard.
From an engineering perspective, I understand.
Yeah, right. Well, and I mean, I think that's a lot of it.
Because people are designing with the limitations of CSS in mind. CSS is based on a box model.
Box.
Thus,
box.
You get boxes.
Box, yes.
Right. Right. Yeah,
however,
that's absolutely. That, yeah, there
that's,
are
that's
various
and sundry.
Yeah,
however,
it
doesn't. I mean, I think many designs that we see out there that are done in CSS now show us that, we don't have to be boxy.
Yeah, at the moment we're kind of hacking our way around that problem.
Yeah, like with rounded corners and everything.
That's my question. How do you get to a more structured thing instead of having to do rounded corners with
a bunch of
multiple divs and all that? Yeah, but you know what? That's so not popular. It's so yesterday.
Yeah,
that's just what
corners.
I just tell my clients.
It's so
that.
Web 2.0.
It's so Web 2.0. We move on from
past
there.
That.
Exactly.
I mean, there's border rate. Corner radius?
Border radius for Mozilla that does. Yeah.
And that's
sort of thing in CSS where there are huge gaps in CSS that an SVG of course will address some of those things as well.
And if browsers ever supported it
in
browsers.
Exactly.
There are plenty of viewers.
Yeah.
If Chris Lilly were in the room, he'd be leaping at the stage right now.
Oh yeah.
But
in bare feet.
Yeah.
VRML.
How many people remember VRML?
VRML.
Look, there's one person in the room who remembers VRML.
No.
Us?
Oh, yeah.
Before CSS.
Well, we do.
Anyway,
because we've been here for more than a decade. Isn't that the point?
So the next question.
Hi.
Yes. Hi.
I was trained as a designer before there was even desktop publishing. So I found my way into this by accident. And as a designer, I understand the principles of print and printing, but I don't know how to run a press. As a designer, I understand the principles of CSS, but I can't code by hand. And I think that to be able to be either a designer or a coder, I mean, that's where it is now. It's really hard to do CSS if you're not a back-end person, at least for me, because I'm a visual person. I was an art major.
Okay.
And it's just really difficult. But even with Dreamweaver, I always go in to the code and I work with it because I understand how to do it. I'm not going to write it myself. So I think going back to the other question, you can be a really good web designer without knowing CSS and to be able to and use it to its advantage. I think how tables got used initially was by designers trying to find a hack to put graphics on online. And I think designers are the ones who continue to improve the appearance of the web in using these various tools that are available to us.
Okay.
Absolutely.
Yeah. I would go with that.
That wasn't a question.
It was a statement.
It was a very eloquent answer.
Statement. Unfortunately, we've run out of time. So those of you who have the questions or anyone else who would like to, absolutely feel free to come up and talk to us. But thank you very much.
Thank you all very much. Quick question for everybody. How many people think that the conversation of CSS needs to keep going? Yes.
Woo!
Glad to hear it.
I've got a panel for next year.